You're listening to First Point Japan's Spotlight Series, where we interview the people and analyze the things that matter for you to establish, build out, and accelerate your Japan business. Only at firstpointjapan.com, where Japanese business begins. And now, here's your host, James Santagata.
Good afternoon. For today's guest, we have with us Tom Furlong from the U.S., actually from Atlanta, Georgia. Tom, how are you doing today?
Doing fine, James. How are you doing?
Very good. Thanks. Now, Tom, you know, you're actually quite a unique individual, I'd say, in my estimation. From, you know, knowing you before previously in Tokyo, I had learned that you not only had industry experience at SIBA Novartis, but also had deep recruiting experience both in the U.S., frontline experience, and also in Japan. And also, I would say for the people that don't know Tom, I have to really say that Tom is probably one of the, if not most hardworking, one of the top 5 or 10 people I've met, extremely organized, and probably most importantly, very insightful and able to take complex subjects and really boil them down into what you need to know to make things happen. Now, Tom, when I came across recently your insights into the recruiting industry of Japan versus U.S. recruiting, it really resonated with me. And I think that was primarily because one of the first things that come up so often for foreign companies either entering the Japan market for the first time or re-entering or rebooting or conducting business here is that the staffing and recruiting market has such giant asymmetrical difficulties or informational asymmetries in Japan vis-a-vis not just the U.S., but Europe, all of America, Asia, that these questions come up again and again. And I think that you really nailed it on the head. And what we'd like to do is learn a bit, talk to you a bit about this, what you learned, and maybe you could start us off giving us a brief sketch of your background, what you've done before, and maybe what you're working on now.
My background in both is kind of a dual career, but the careers, actually the skill sets are the same for both. My background has been in sales as well as in the recruiting function. Where the role is that when you're talking with a prospect, be it a prospective company or prospective candidate, is that you've got to understand what their needs are and what they're looking for, and then you deliver the solution that helps fill that need. As an example, I was a recruiter, mainly on the agency side of recruiting, for almost 8 years here in the States. And then I transitioned from that role into working with Novartis into their sales function with their subsidiary CibaVision. And I ended up being with numerous sales and sales leadership roles there for over a 13-year period. And again, the skill sets are the same. You're going out and you're just building business, building relationships, understanding needs, and then at that point, then delivering from a portfolio the best product to fill the need of the client. I did have the opportunity, actually my wife had the opportunity through her employment to transfer to Japan for a couple of years. So we moved to Japan in 2006, fourth quarter 2006. It took me about a year to get acclimated to the society, learn enough Japanese to be proficient in business, and then also to receive a work visa. And then after I'd gotten the visa issues taken care of, I ended up working with, which is a leading professional search firm in Tokyo, working with bilingual professionals. Did that, and then as that business was beginning to grow, my wife was transferred back to the States. I came back here, and at the time it was during the beginning of the Great Recession here in the States. So I, rather than try to find employment, though I was looking, I set up my own consulting business, which I ran for about 3 years, where I was working with companies, basically taking social media, which at this time was just starting to become very active, taking concepts from social media and from branding and applying those concepts to attracting primarily younger talent. And I did that for 3 years, was working on several projects. And while I was finishing up a project last year, I was approached by a firm called Harvard Group International, which is based here in Atlanta, which is an executive search firm, strictly retained search. And after I finished my last project at the end of 2011, I was able to make a transition. And I've been there now since that point.
Okay, great, great. Excellent. So yeah, I think you definitely have a very well-rounded and deep experience in this area. By the way, when you were doing recruiting in Japan, were you in a particular industry vertical? Do you have any specialization, or what practice group were you with?
I was working in the life science industry.
Oh, life science. Okay, great. When so it ties in directly with your Novartis and SIBA experience in the industry, I guess.
And prior to that, when I was in the recruiting business before I went to work for Novartis, I was in the life science industry recruiting as well. That was primarily sales and marketing roles. I did have a chance to fill a couple of industrial positions within the life science industry for some manufacturers. So again, and even now with what my work is with the Harvard Group, I am working, one of the verticals I am working is the life science area.
Oh, okay, great, great. And I also think that gives you a lot of, in fact, one of the most unique things I've seen is when we talk today, we're really comparing, you know, apples and apples, because you've got the recruiting in the same vertical of life science in both the U.S. and Japan with the industry background. So it kind of gives us a view of how all the parties view this and what some of the differences are. That it's not perhaps an industry difference, but it may be issues with the market and the dynamics themselves as well. So that's great. Okay, great. Yeah, so I was looking at the presentation you'd made, that the recruiting U.S. versus Japan, and I thought, first off, it was great. You had comparison of the different industry models, the client viewpoints, the candidate pools, and what some of the search firms' process or business models are. Within the industry comparison, you had, I thought, which caught my eye, which comes up a lot, you mentioned that in the U.S. it's client-focused, but in Japan it's candidate-focused. Could you share maybe your insights or what you mean by that?
Absolutely. In the United States, in the recruiting industry, the predominance of your efforts are geared towards account development, developing relationships with business. Both on the retained side and the contingency side of the business, your goal is to always have a stream of opportunities of searches to work. Without the searches to work, there isn't a whole lot of opportunity. And the Japanese model is quite the opposite, because of the tenured, because of the long-term employment, the culture fit, that candidates or employees are very reluctant to change positions. In the recruiting model in Japan, you really have to be focused on developing relationships with the candidate base. In terms of, you've got to gain their trust and gain their understanding, and then find out what is that one factor that might motivate them to consider making a job change. If you find a candidate who's willing to make a change and they have talent, there will be companies, again, primarily more the multinationals as opposed to the Japan-based companies. The multinational companies are certainly willing to attract quality talent. And so if you have got a candidate who's willing to make a change and has got a talent background, skill set to bring to an employer, the recruiter generally will not have problems finding a company to take that candidate.
I see. Interesting. Now you also talked about, maybe this is drilling down there, you mentioned the large candidate pool versus a small candidate pool. And I guess also we should say is what we're talking about here is recruiting for bilinguals for the Gaishke. So these are Japanese who most likely Japanese nationals, could be some foreigners, but they native Japanese speakers, and they're bilingual either in English or another language, ideally at a business level as well. So could you speak a bit what you mean between those two? And by the way, Gaishke would be the foreign capital of firms. So it would be perhaps Novartis coming into Japan, which would be a foreign company, versus the domestic. Could you expand a little bit on that, what you mean by the large and small, and maybe why you think that is?
I sure will, and I'll cover maybe a little bit further in the presentation about the differences between candidates in America versus candidates in Japan. And when I say America, I feel that these traits probably are going to be applicable throughout the Western world. It could be in Europe or North America, as well as the U.S. But in the U.S. model, the employees really have low loyalty to their employers. The candidates or the employees always have one eye open on the next opportunity. They are the old industrial model of working for one company for life disappeared many years ago in America. And especially with the younger generations growing up, there is no loyalty to the employer. They just see it as a means to an end, either for career advancement or for monetary gain. Because of that, again, their candidates are always open to, almost without exception, are always open to hear about new opportunities. There isn't in America as much anymore a stigma on having changed jobs. Whereas in the past, when I say in the past, I'm going back maybe 15, 20 years ago, when I first started getting into recruiting, if a candidate had two or three job changes in an 8 to 10 year period, that was a red flag. Now, if a candidate has two to three job changes in an 8 to 10 year period, that's like, hey, this is a very stable candidate.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. On the other side, in Japan, where you still have basically the wedded philosophy of employer and employee, the employees have much more loyalty to their employer. And more importantly, they feel it's dishonorable to make a change from the employer to even consider new opportunities. They feel that they're being disrespectful or dishonorable to the company that they're working for. The term is shushin koyo, which is basically translates into long-term employment, which means that the longer a person is working with a company, their pay is going to increase more based on tenure and seniority, not necessarily on accomplishment. And not only that, as they grow longer into the tenure with the company, their duties and responsibilities will actually decrease over time. So pay goes up, responsibility and duties decrease. If someone has been with a company then for 15 to 20 years, there's a concern in their mind that if they go to work for a new company, they'll be the low man on the totem pole. They'll have to work the longer hours for the less money and have to report to people that maybe aren't as qualified as they are, strictly because they have made a change in their career and not because, even on an organizational chart, they may be at a higher level or have higher responsibility. They feel that they will have less prestige. I think two other things that really tie into that. One is that, in general, Japan is a risk-averse culture. People are unwilling to make that big risk, and that is for employers as well. But the other thing, which doesn't really get talked about a lot, is the retirement age in Japan being at age 60.
Okay.
With that being the case, that generally your career lifespan for an employee is only about 30 to 35 years. Generally, after coming out of college and if there's any military service, a person is really going to be starting their career about age 23 to 25, and that gives them a good 35 years in work, and then they're done with their career. Whereas in America, you're seeing people who maybe are bypassing college, they're starting their career or starting a career in conjunction with college. So they may be joining the workforce at a younger age, maybe around age 20 or so, and they may work to age 70. So you're looking at now these days that, you know, a person coming out of college is looking at probably a close to a 50-year career span. So certainly, if nothing else, there's going to be need a variety just to keep the person sharp. Whereas in Japan, if you've got a 30-year career and that's it, there isn't really a need after 15 years when you get that maybe an itch to try something new. It's more like, well, why make a change now? I'm so close to retirement.
I see. Okay, that makes sense. Great. Now, also, this is maybe playing into that, maybe with the amount of candidate pool. You mentioned in the U.S. the clients are willing to wait for a, quote, exact fit, whereas in Japan, a close fit or good enough may be suitable or maybe may be fine. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Because of the employment situation in America, even more so now than it was a few years ago, where there's so many more people out there looking for a job who are unemployed currently, as well as those that are underemployed or those that may feel that their situation is tenuous at their current company, that maybe the company isn't stable, they may not be in business in another 2 to 3 years. Because there's such a glut of candidates available on the market, employers can say, we've got a list of, it could be 8, it could be 10, it could be 15 criteria that could be legitimate or they could just be artificially created criteria. But if a candidate doesn't hit every one of those 15 points, they can say, we'll wait till the candidate does come along that meets those needs because we will be able to find that kind of person. Whereas maybe in years past, if a company had 15 ideal qualities they would like and they found a candidate that maybe had 11 or 12 of those, they'd say, this is a great match. Let's take them. Now the companies are saying, you know, we'll keep looking. On the other side in Japan, because again, when you have a need for an employee, there's a certain talent need within the company, they can't afford to be picky because, again, the talent pool is so small to begin with. If they see someone that maybe makes 8 or 10 of the criteria of the 15 that the company had set out, they figure, well, hey, 2/3 is better than what we're going to find elsewhere. We'll take that candidate. So the company really is more concerned about filling the opening now, not necessarily waiting to the exact match falls into place.
I see. And that probably also is what we talked about earlier, is because of the small candidate pool and the demand from Gaishke or other people for that talent, close fit may be good enough for now. And if you wait for best fit or exact fit, that may never happen or may be months away and may have other impacts on the business by not filling that position. The opportunity that cost, I guess, would be very great by waiting 6 months or a year to fill that particular position then.
Well, absolutely. And again, it's more of a cost-reward situation. I mean, even in America, when you find that exact fit, sometimes companies are unwilling to pull that trigger because they feel, again, we found this first candidate that's a perfect fit. How many more are out there? Maybe there's even a better fit out there.
Right, sure. Okay, great. Now, also, this was, I think, really, you mentioned this too, and this really resonates with me. As you know, may know, we focus primarily on high-tech recruiting, so chip, software, et cetera. But it comes up a lot, not only talking to, we're based in Tokyo, Japan, but talking to the recruiters such as yourself in North America or Europe or even clients, which is the differences of the current fee structure for the recruiting or the executive search fees in Europe or North America versus Japan. And you talked a little bit about the pressure that's between these, but can you maybe fill us in a little bit or talk a little bit about some of the differences that you've seen of how fees are structured, even what the rates may be between North America or outside the rest of the world versus Japan?
I will, James. There's a saying that's so true. There's always someone out there who's willing to do it for less than you.
Okay.
And that has really been a mantra in the recruiting business, at least here in the United States, mm-hmm. where – and I'm trying to think the best way to phrase this. If I can go back a couple of years, when the Great Recession first hit, a number of executives were let go from their companies or they were given golden parachutes to leave their companies. And they felt, well, hey, I can go out and be a recruiter. It's very easy. All I got to pick up the phone and make some calls. They realized on the business model is that, well, you know, in order to get business or attention from a client when you're new to the industry, the only way you can really do that is by price competition. By saying if the standard fee rate is 30%, I'll do it for 25. If you're willing to pay 25%, well, I'll do it for 20. And there's extreme downward pressure because there were so many people flooding the market, new recruiters flooding the market, that they were able to really drive the fees down. What affected, though, was because of this downward pressure, these inexperienced people going into business, is that service suffered, positions weren't being filled, they weren't filled with inadequate candidates, so it was really a hard sell approach by the recruiter. Companies started putting value back into their relationship with long-term recruiters, and the fees actually started to rise back up. So that now here in the United States, the average fee you're going to find on a contingency search is going to be – the standard is 20% of the starting –
Now, are we talking – we say OTE in Japan, on-target earnings. Is this total earnings or only on a basis, or does it vary? How does that play out?
The position is probably more of an on-target earning in the sense that if it's on a sales position or a position with compensation by bonus, it would be what would be expected bonus at 100% performance.
Okay.
But in terms of like perks, salary increases after 6 months, insurance and things like that, they would be that's not included into the fee computation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Got it. Now, and what did you see in Japan then? What was some of your insights into that?
This really gets back to where I'm at now on the contingent. I mean, on the retained side of the search, with executive search anyway, because the positions are much more critical to a company, employers are not flinching at 30% to 35% fees.
I see,
and those are paid up front before the first candidate's even presented. Or again, there might be an arrangement set up where you take a part of the fee now and part of the fee later. Mm. In Japan, when I was working there, the standard fee was right at 30% to 35%. One of my clients I worked with, they initially hesitated at 35%, but because of the service I was able to provide and the candidate, they were willing to pay the 35%, even though their parent company in Switzerland had sent out a worldwide edict saying no more than 30% fees for the Japan market. They still were able to go grandfather was in at 35%. I believe, though, the current rate is still somewhere in that 30% range. And again, it's I would feel based more on supply and demand. That again, when you don't have many candidates that are available for a search, you could offer to do a search for 10%. But if you don't have a candidate, you can't fill the position. So I think there is more of a pressure on the client side to pay the higher fee only because again there's not much of a supply for quality talent that's available right now.
Okay, yes. And also to give you a little data point, this is mostly from the tech side. When I came into the market 6 years ago in tech, the probably the average rate or I'd say I guess I wouldn't say the average, probably the median rate, not the arithmetic mean, was about 35% on target earnings. But there were numerous cases where companies had urgent hirings, even Microsoft, EDS, where they were paying 40 to even 50%. Of course, that was quite an anomaly. Then, during 2007, 8-ish period, it began to move back to 35. And now after the crash, it still it hangs around 30. There's some cases where they may be 25% or 30. But as you said, it depends. If you're looking for more of a plain vanilla person, where there's a lot of them, it's a lot different. If you're looking for, I forget the term they use in the medical industry, medical rep, MR, that type of thing. Maybe they're going to pay a premium because they're so hard to find. Same with some FAEs or top talent. But the fees are still seem to be much higher in Japan because of all of these issues and the fact that I think even the candidate, we call it the velocity of transaction, but the time period and energy usually needed to locate these individuals and then shepherd them through the process is usually quite long as well. So there's a lot of effort, I think, put in maintaining those relations with the candidate as well, at least on the tech side.
As I said earlier, that you can always find someone to offer a lower fee or a lower price. I think the same thing is true in the recruiting industry in Japan, that you can always find a candidate to take a position. But is that going to be an ideal candidate? Is it going to be a good fit for the company? That's what's going to take the longer period of time to find that candidate is going to be a good match for the company. But if a company is just saying, we want to see bodies, that can easily be accomplished. But the quality of the candidates is not going to be strong.
I see. Okay. Now another thing you mentioned I thought was quite interesting, and you touched on it briefly. Within the U.S., a high number of both active and passive candidates, and then in Japan, perhaps a different number. First off, for those that may not know, could you define or maybe briefly describe what is active candidate and what is passive?
An active candidate is a person who is actively open to looking for a job or is actively searching for a new position. They are willing to take the call from the recruiter. They're willing to interview with anybody and everybody, even if they're currently employed, because they're either not happy in their current position or they feel they can get a better compensation at a new opportunity. And so they're willing to entertain any opportunity that might sound reasonable to them. A passive candidate is going to be someone who either is not considering making a change, but might be open for some. Might be open if someone were to present the opportunity to them, or someone who is just satisfied where they are and they're not going to leave the company no matter what. That and the passive candidate, I think in Japan, you're really going to find those candidates are just those are not even willing to consider talking about a new opportunity. It's not like, well, hey, that sounds pretty good. I wasn't looking, but I'll certainly go talk with the company. It's more like I'm just not going to make the effort or willing to consider the opportunity that might be presented there.
That makes sense. Okay, great. Also, you mentioned another one I think was quite interesting, the risk-averse culture. I know I can kind of, well, of course, I'm in the market, but for those that may not be in Japan or see it, can you maybe describe a bit of especially for Americans, that we kind of maybe have a variety of on a continuum of risk or aversion to it, but you know, what would, how would that be different than perhaps what we see in North America, how people might view things? How does risk kind of manifest itself? Or could you give some examples of what you see in that area for in terms of candidates?
Well, absolutely. I think in America, risk is actually rewarded. Americans really enjoy the celebrity of someone who is a person willing to take risk and be open about it. I think one person that comes to mind is Donald Trump, a real estate mogul who has had many successes and failures in his career, but he really is very upfront about saying, I'll take a risk, and if I lose $1 million or $100 million on this deal, well, no biggie, because at least I tried it, and you know, I might have made $1 billion, but I ended up losing $100 million. Well, you know, I'll just go out and make another $100 million tomorrow and then not worry about it. I think, again, that's the entrepreneurial spirit. When you look at companies we mentioned earlier, like Microsoft, like Apple, these were companies that took tremendous risk just to get started, as opposed to Bill Gates or Steve Jobs maybe working in a company like an IBM or a Hewlett-Packard, which would have been the normal career track for them back in the early 80s. Instead, they went out and they formed their own business and made these giant empires. In Japan, the concern is that being risk-averse is that if there's a mistake happens or there's a loss, that there's going to be a loss of face and a loss of honor. And inaction would be preferable than taking a wrong action that ends up not being successful.
I see.
Okay. Whereas in America, sometimes companies will say, you know, if you're not making mistakes, if you're not having failures, you're just not trying hard enough. That if you've got 8 successes and 1 failure, well, then we're going to applaud the successes and learn from the failure. In Japan, if you have 8 successes and 1 failure, your career is over. Your reputation is I'll use an American term. Your reputation is toast. It doesn't matter all the great things you did. You had this one failure, and because of that, we can't trust you with any future projects. I think, and again, this is going to be maybe a little stereotypical, but I certainly found it to be true, as did my wife when she worked in Japan, that people will have meetings to determine when they want to have a meeting to make a decision. No one wants to be the one to make the decision. They want to go by consensus, which is good, but then also it's very induces paralysis, and it really stifles innovation. And I think that's unfortunately a common pathology, if you will, throughout Japanese business culture.
Okay, interesting. Now, something else you brought up, and I think this should be brought up as well. You mentioned the retirement age, and one thing I think, again, our programs are pretty much the real politic of business, the way business actually works in Japan versus the way we might expect it. So it would be more of the positive view versus a normative, I wish the world worked that way. Within the U.S., of course, there's very strong the EOE laws in terms of asking certain questions about age or marriage or gender and this type of thing. And in Japan, although some of these are actually frowned upon or maybe illegal, there's an issue in Japan where what we call broken spring legislation or rules, where it looks like there may be a spring on the door, but until you actually use it, you don't know if it functions or not. Yes. And one of the things that comes up is this idea of, not so much in the gaishke, but in some areas, of looking at the age of the candidate, and not so much that the candidate is not able to perform, but that because of the Japanese, I'm not sure what we'd call it, seniority system or the respect for age people, having a person of a certain age difference between the manager may make both parties feel uncomfortable. Could you talk about that, or have you experienced that at all with any candidates or clients mentioning that in the Japan market?
Well, it happened to me personally when I had received my work visa and was starting out to find employment, and I had talked with several search firms who point blank said, well, you would be the oldest person here by far, older than the owners, older than the workers. We just don't want to have that situation.
I see.
On the other hand, when I went to Ingenium Group, their management team there was like, you're the person we're looking for. We need someone who's got more seniority, who can go out and talk with the senior level Japanese, be it a candidate or a client, to develop the business. because you've got the experience and you've got the credibility. When you're talking to a country manager who's maybe in his mid-50s about making a career change, you have a lot more credibility than someone who's maybe 20 years younger.
I see, but I
think what you say is certainly valid in Japanese in terms of the hierarchy, and as I mentioned earlier about the loss of prestige, that if you've got a senior employee, as an example, say maybe someone in their mid-50s, reporting to a manager who might be 10 years that employee's junior, especially if it's male to male. I guess more importantly, if it was a male to a male reporting to a female supervisor who was 10 years younger, there would be certainly a lot of issues or uncomfort, because that would still be a new situation in Japan. And I think, again, part of it's just a situation where they aren't used to having either men work for women or older people working for younger people, whereas in America, that's been a standard for generations.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Interesting enough, one of the things I've noticed, we see this in tech a lot, maybe because it's so dynamic in terms of mostly deregulated or minimal regulation. And, there's always something coming out with something better and companies are dying off or merging. But this seems to cut both ways where imagine you had the manager maybe in their 40s and the candidate was 30. That's acceptable. But if it's reversed, not only do you sometimes find that the hiring manager may feel, on the Japanese side, feel uncomfortable with the more seasoned employee. But I've been surprised sometimes, even with unemployed candidates that have limited options, the Japanese themselves may feel uncomfortable as a candidate to work for a manager who's younger than them themselves. So, and not so much that they felt uncomfortable, but that they would feel that they would make their manager uncomfortable. So sort of like projecting this wah or harmony as well, which I think is kind of unique, at least, you know, as myself being American, coming from, not a perfect society, but at least a little bit more, you know, we consider egalitarian or based on meritocracy, as opposed to the reverence for ages and some of these things. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
I think you bring up a good point. If I can elaborate just a little more.
Sure.
On the candidate side, that, and I never realized this before till you just mentioned it, but I've seen this. And I can certainly see where you're coming from, the point that the candidate doesn't want to make his supervisor or supervisor, prospective supervisor, to be uncomfortable by having to work with an older candidate. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think in America, at least in American business, there is some relevance to the seniority and the experience an older candidate can bring to a position. Mm-hmm. Again, I think in Japan, it's more like, again, it's almost like a loss of status if a seasoned executive now has to report to someone considerably younger than themselves, that there is that loss of prestige, and they may choose to, rather than have that loss of prestige, just not to accept the position at all and continue looking for other opportunities.
I see. Now, another interesting thing, too, and maybe this is a social trend, you had mentioned the difference within at least the U.S. market of people working to a longer part past what may have been standard retirement, whereas in Japan there's the mandatory retirement. And one of the things that has struck me is I think Japan still has, if not the longest, the second longest life expectancy or lifespan of any of the industrialized, or actually any of the nations of the world. And we see guys that are in their late 50s or just turned 60 that are, they look, you know, in just great shape. They're razor sharp. They've got all the connections. They got things happening, and yet in a lot of these firms, they wouldn't be employable. And yet Japan also is running into some labor issues with declining birth rate. What do you think happens to these people? I mean, does that have to change, or that seems to me to be untapped resources for the nation? It'd be akin to, I guess, taking a tree and making a toothpick out of it and throwing the rest of it away.
I think that's a very serious issue with the Japanese economy, and I think if it's addressed properly, it will go a long way to helping resolve some of the economic issues that are currently in Japan. That being that you've got an elderly, rapidly aging population, and there's no one to take care of them, and there's a significant segment of that population that I would describe as, use the Japanese term of genki, where they certainly have their full mental faculties, they have their physical faculties, they have a lot to contribute, But because of the mandatory retirement age, they are not able to contribute. I remember when I first moved to Japan and I went to a tourist bureau. And the gentleman I talked with there, I could tell was extremely polished, extremely articulate, spoke English very well. I could tell he was maybe be looking his age, maybe late 60s. And it turned out he was a senior, a CEO or a C-level employee at a major Japanese corporation. Once he became 60, he was retired, left the company, and then he's now doing volunteer work at the tourist agency, helping foreign tourists find their way around Japan. And I'm thinking to myself, this is a person that certainly could be, at that time, would be able to run maybe Sony, maybe a pharmaceutical firm like Takeda, maybe a high-ranking official there. But, you know, here he is doing volunteer work at the tourist board because he's 65, 66 years old. Whereas in America, and I'm finding this more and more as I'm dealing now with my executive search, that there are many senior leaders, when they choose to work, or now working into the late 60s, early 70s, and these are at senior level roles and working with Fortune 500 companies at a very high level of competency.
I see.
I think, again, getting back to the Japanese situation, is that if they were able to maybe take a large segment of these people, maybe between ages 60 and 65 or 60 and 67, who are willing to work, they could be gainfully employed, could contribute a lot to their companies. That would, A, reduce unemployment, in the, not that it considered unemployment. It would reduce the number of inactive workers. It would have more people working. It would keep the economy stimulated because there would be more money going through the economy because you have more people working.
Yes, yes. Also, as a very strange anecdote, I ran into much of what you said about that travel bureau. Before I was recruiting, I was on the tech side at Applied Materials, one of the semiconductor processing equipment companies, and I was managing the Japan market. And one of the things that was shocking to me was that near some of the towns where there's a lot of semicon work, like out in Hachioji, about an hour out from Tokyo, you'll notice that unlike – I don't want to stereotype all cab drivers in the U.S., but sometimes it's not really the best desired job where you might get some surly behavior. But when you would pay for the ride, you'd have people that would guess what the fare would be and had pre-stacked coins in a little wrapper to give to you. And then as I began to talk to them, you realize that a lot of these guys had been retired from Rome or Oki, and they were semiconductor process engineers, or – you could talk to these guys and they were now driving a cab, but they had previously been a process engineer or someone, you know, building all of these high-tech things, but there was nowhere for them to be utilized in the current system, because Japan also at that time, this was back in 1995, 96, 97, there wasn't even a mid-hire structure in the Japanese company. You came in as a fresh graduate, and you worked your way up, and mid-hires were never heard of. You know, it was in the States. You know, those are often – there's so much cross-pollination, and the idea that someone bringing in this outside knowledge or business acumen is valued. It was really shocking to me. This still goes on, and it just seems eventually that's a real untapped resource that I think that hopefully will begin to be utilized here as well.
Well, I think that adds to the pathology about candidates not willing to make a change. As you said, as I mentioned earlier, and you just highlighted there, if you're a mid-level manager and you want to make a change, at many times, either the company is going to put you into the entry-level role and you got to work your way back up the ladder, or the people that are currently there are going to view you as the entry-level guy working your way back up the ladder, whereas actually you could bring a lot of new business ideas, new energy, to make the enterprise a lot more successful. But again, and this is even today, there's just that reluctance to bring in someone with new thoughts and new ideas, or someone that maybe wants to contribute, but they know they're not going to have a receptive audience, so they decide, why make a change? I'll just stay where I'm at. At least it's better than starting at the ground floor.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Great. Okay, Tom, actually, you know, we're coming up against the clock here. We could go on for, you know, your wealth of information, go on for much longer. I did notice we had talked actually previous to this that you had some additional insights into the actual sourcing a market in Japan. So maybe we could schedule another talk and have you back on the show and discuss that at a later date and go into some of those as well, if that would be of interest to you.
Well, I'd be more than happy to do that, James, at any time.
Great. Okay, great. Tom, do you have anything last to wrap up or anything you'd like to add?
Not really that we haven't covered already. I try not to repeat myself. The one thing about when doing public speaking is that it's a matter of making sure you know what you're going to say and then not repeating yourself.
I say, okay, sure.
But I think, no, just in terms of like in general, I even though I've been away from the Japanese market now for a couple of years, my reports from the colleagues I'm still in touch with in Japan are, much like yourself, James, are telling me the same thing, that the situations are basically the same, that when foreign companies are coming into Japan or they want to make a change, they don't understand the fact that the searches take a lot longer and they're more expensive to find maybe not the quality of candidates. I mean, again, I have clients I work with now that says, just send me your first 15 people and we'll call from that point. Whereas in Japan, if you will never find 15 candidates for any role. I mean, you're lucky if you can maybe find 3 to 5 quality candidates. And I think that's still the case today. So I like to warn clients I work with who've talked about expanding into Japan or expanding into Asia, that it's going to be a different mindset and a different dynamic on search for experienced candidates than what you're going to be used to here in the United States.
Okay, that's great. Great. Okay, well, Tom, thank you very much for your time. I think we've learned a lot from you, and we look forward to talking with you next time about the sourcing in Japan.
I look forward to talking to you about it, James. Great. Thank you.
Great. All right, thank you, Tom.
All right, have a good day.
Good night.
Our guest tonight was Tom Furlong out of Atlanta, Georgia, Managing Director at the Harvard Group International. And our theme tonight was the recruiting industry, the dynamics, and the comparison between the United States and Japan. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. This program has been a presentation of First Point Japan, where we interview the people and analyze the things that matter for you to establish, build out, and accelerate your Japan business. Only at firstpointjapan.com, where Japanese business begins.